Well, this is a hard moment to make the claim that things are improving. So I don't know what the historical trends are. I do know that the people that we work with, whether it's in the business world or in people's personal lives, are making choices to apply some of the skills around how to have these conversations more effectively. And I think it's helping people. I don't think there's anything that's going to, you know, turn difficult conversations into easy, fun conversations. And certainly there's nothing that's going to be a panacea in terms of our political conversations at the national level. But I think it just comes down for all of us at some level to just having one conversation at a time with people who see things differently from us and being willing to share how we see things and try to understand how someone else sees things.
I suppose one major difference from when the book first came out 17, 18 years ago is that a lot of the conversations, and maybe we need to use a different term, but a lot of the interactions we're having are now happening online. Do you see that as really impacting how we're interacting with each other?
Yeah, I think, this is nothing, these are not my particular insights, but I think the extent to which we're communicating online and there's anonymity and people are, you know, hiding behind their computers and saying crazy things and everyone's getting in on the act. So I think we're at a kind of transitional moment where we're trying to get used to some new norms and it's been tough. When I work with our own clients, the first thing we tell people is if you can meet in person, if you can even just pick up the phone, anything is going to be better than email, and email is better than just posting something on a website.
Well, this book, Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most, is the chosen book for Conflict Resolution Month in Colorado. Every year, a book is recommended for the community at large to read with the goals of spreading information and encouraging conversations on ways to manage conflict at all levels of society, from the very basic interpersonal and families to, you know, broader society. And this is a book that really explores different things. So the idea behind the book is that we all face difficult conversations every day. What makes a conversation difficult?
Yeah, well, so that's a great question. I should start out by saying there's nothing wrong. The fact that we have difficult conversations in our lives doesn't mean there's something wrong with us or something wrong with our relationships. It's just an inevitable part of people being in human relationships. What makes them difficult? I think it can be different things in different situations. Sometimes it's that two people just see something very, very differently, coming from very different backgrounds or having very different concerns. Sometimes there are strong emotions involved where someone feels very angry or they feel threatened and anxious. And a third thing that makes conversations difficult is that sometimes when we engage in certain kinds of conversations, the conversation itself can feel like it's threatening our sense of who we are in the world. So if, for example, I see myself as being a very generous, giving person, and I have to turn somebody down for something, or they ask for a favor and I can't do it, there's a number of reasons why that might feel difficult to me. But one of them is that it has the potential to threaten how I see myself, that in general, I think of myself as being generous and I want to say yes. And here I am saying no. And so what does that mean about who I am?
Somebody gave me advice once when you are going to go in and have a difficult conversation that you know there will be some level of conflict, is go in with the mental attitude of positive intent, that I will assume positive intent on my behalf and on the behalf of other people in that interaction. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, similar. I don't know if I go so far as to say assume positive intent. Although I think as a sort of one sentence guideline that works as well as any, I think the most important thing is just for all of us to recognize that when we're interacting with other people, we tell stories in our minds about why they're doing what they're doing. Did they say that to hurt me or to put me down? So we make up stories about what's motivating the other person. And when we're in conflict, those stories tend to be negative. We think they're intending to harm us or to scare us or to show us who's boss. And the point from my point of view is just to recognize that we generally don't know what's motivating other people. It's possible that sometimes they really are trying to put us down, or they're trying to look good in front of the boss at our expense. But very often people are motivated by things that are just not, they're not even related to us. They're just doing something else and happens to have a bad impact on us. So if you can remind yourself before a difficult conversation, just to be open about the fact that, you know, I don't know what was motivating them when they said that or did that. And so I'm open to finding out.
Well, this book, I know, really seeks to have people shift their perception of when you're going into a conversation, shift from a message delivery stance to a learning stance. What does that mean?
Yeah, so there are very few conversations where the only point of the conversation is to get your message across. If a child runs out into the street, that's you're yelling at them to come back and to be safe. So that really is delivering a message. But in most conversations, if you're talking to a partner in an intimate relationship, even if the topic from your point of view has to do with them, you know, they're coming home late from work every day and you're feeling upset and sad about that, you might think, well, the topic of that conversation, it's just I need to deliver the message that they're coming home late every day and that's bad and they got to stop doing that. But really, that conversation is not going to go well and it's not going to be successful unless you see that conversation as a two-way conversation where on your end, you might say, I've been feeling lonely. I'm confused about why you've been working so often so late and that's been upsetting me. But I want to hear from your point of view what's going on with you, what's motivating you? How have you been feeling in the relationship? Are there things that I'm doing maybe that are making you less interested in coming home the way you used to, and so forth? So almost all good conversations are going to end up being two-way conversations where both people are learning.
It seems that we don't teach, well, certainly if you look at, you know, from the beginning, we don't teach listening skills. And how we often deal with children is this one-way conversation where we're telling them to do something. And we often, I know as parents, fail to listen in a way that I think is meaningful, that maybe could teach those listening skills. How can we get better as a society at listening to each other when we seem to be failing right from the beginning with children?
Yeah, well, that's a great observation. As parents, you know, we, for the first number of years, if we want our children to do something, we just pick them up and move them to where we want them. We don't even have to necessarily have a conversation. And then it can move into the sort of because I say so mode where I'm the parent, you're the child, you do what I say because I'm the parent. And then we can sometimes go into the sort of like, well, you're a teenager, you're impossible. That explains all the difficulties. So, you know, by the time we get to the child is 20 years old, we haven't had a real experience of sitting down and trying to understand their concerns, them trying to understand our concerns. And it's not because we're, trying to be bad parents or not trying to communicate well. It just tends to be the way we do things. So I think you're right that we sort of come from these models of there's a person who tells you what to do, and then there's a person that does it, and then we get into society, and we don't have a lot of practice either listening to others or, for that matter, being listened to. And I think a great place to start, actually, is with our children. Parents will often say to me, how can I get my teenager or how can I get my child to listen to me? So the parent wants to be listened to. And my answer is always, well, I would start by listening to your child. And the parent will say, no, you misunderstood my question. I want my child to listen to me. But in fact, I think one of the best ways to get somebody to actually listen to us is to listen to them first. I could talk about listening for hours and hours and hours, paradoxically maybe, but I do think it's the most important skill around conflict resolution and communication. It's the most important thing that we can be working on.
We're speaking this morning on KGNU with Douglas Stone, one of the co-authors of the book Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. It was originally published in 1999 and there was a 10-year anniversary edition that was put out in 2010. And it's the chosen book for Conflict Resolution Month in Colorado. Every year, Conflict Resolution Month in Colorado recommends a book for the community at large with the goals of spreading information and encouraging conversation on ways to manage conflicts at all levels of society. The co-authors of the book, along with Doug Stone, are Bruce Patton and Sheila Heen, and they're all with the Harvard Negotiation Project. Douglas, there are so many different ways to have a conversation. Every single conversation is going to be different. However, you do identify three different types of conversations that are pretty consistent within every type of difficult conversation. So let's touch on all of those, and I'll just identify them first. The what happened conversation, then there's the feelings conversation, and then the identity conversation. What is the what happened conversation?
Yeah, so when we first started working on the book, Difficult Conversations, the original title actually was going to be The 10 Hardest Things to Say and How to Say Them. And people like this title because people like lists and they like that kind of angle. And we started writing, each chapter was going to be one of the hard things to say. And so there was like breaking up with somebody or firing somebody or apologizing or saying I love you, whatever the topics were. And what we found from beginning to write each of those chapters was that we were saying the same, we were giving the same advice over and over again. And what we really noticed was that in spite of the topic at hand, whatever the actual substance of the difficult conversation, that really there are sort of three levels of communication going on at once. And as you mentioned, the first level is what we call the what happened conversation. And so a conversation is going to have a topic, right? So if we're talking about, again, two spouses and one of them is feeling like they're not spending enough time together, so the topic is, are we spending enough time together? And people will sort of talk that through in terms of, well, yes, no, whose fault is that? What have we been doing? What should we be doing? And there are some systematic mistakes that we make when we talk about the substance of the conversation. A second kind of level of the conversation is what we call the feelings conversation. And that just means that if a conversation is difficult for one or both people, there's probably going to be some important and strong emotions involved, whether it's anger or fear or sadness or hurt, anxiety, etc. I think one of the mistakes we make there, and especially in the workplace, I would say, is we tend to think that, again, especially at work, that we're not supposed to have feelings at work. We sort of check our feelings at the door. And you could argue whether that's a good policy or a bad policy. But in the end, it sort of doesn't really matter because, in fact, you can't check your feelings at the door. Your feelings are inside of you. They're not like a piece of clothing that you can leave somewhere. And so the real question that we have to ask is not sort of should you have feelings, but what should you do with the feelings that you're inevitably going to have? And there are sort of different thoughts about what's going to be helpful around that aspect of the conversation. And then the third level is what we call the identity conversation, which says that one of the key factors that makes a conversation difficult, not just the substance and topic of the conversation, it's not just that there may be strong feelings, but the conversation itself has the potential to threaten how you see yourself. So as I mentioned earlier, if you see yourself as a generous person and you find in the conversation that you are not being generous or you're saying no, you're turning someone down, then one reason the conversation's challenging is literally because this very important thing, which is your sense of who you are in the world, can feel threatened. And so one of the, I think, most useful things about the book Difficult Conversations is that too often I think we experience a conversation as being kind of amorphously difficult. Conversation is difficult just because it's confusing and difficult. But if you actually think systematically, you can kind of go through and ask yourself, what's going on at each of these levels, at the level of the substance, at the level of feelings, and at the level of identity, and you can start to unravel what's really going on, what's driving it, what's making it hard, and you can make some choices that make it a little bit easier.
Well, in the book, you have a lot of examples, and a lot of them are workplace examples. And I know that this is has been very popular amongst business people and how to have these difficult conversations at work, but it also is incredibly applicable at all aspects of society. And at the book, you have the 10 different questions that people ask about this particular book. And one of them relates to a question I asked you at the beginning. And certainly when the book first came out in 1999, most difficult conversations were in person or on the phone. Now in 2017, a lot of difficult conversations are happening digitally, on email, on Twitter, if you could call Twitter a conversation, on other aspects of social media. Now, you did say that it's always best to have a face-to-face or on phone conversation, but given, particularly if we get back to the work environment, a lot of people aren't having those opportunities, or even in interpersonal situations, a lot of people now, their only engagement with other people or certain people is online and in that digital platform. So what advice can you give them for having these difficult conversations in the digital space?
Yeah, so that's absolutely right. And it's really important to be thinking about the digital aspects of communication. So some of the guidelines are kind of simple things, but which I think can have a big positive impact. If I get an email, for example, that I find upsetting, my tendency is to want to write back immediately, and it's going to have my response is going to have all kinds of kind of hurt feelings and righteousness mixed in. Here, one sec, let me just get a little drink of water. But one of the guidelines that I try to follow as much as possible is if I'm upset or sort of taken aback, surprised by an email, I just don't respond right away. I try to either wait and if I can, I try to wait till the next day, but at least a couple hours. And what I do is I'll just spend a little time away, and then I'll read the email again 24 hours later. And the amazing thing to me is that very often the thing that upset me the first time I read it, it will turn out that I sort of misinterpreted it, or I read part of it, or I read it wrong. So just having that time to calm down and not fire off the first thing that comes into your head can be really important. I guess related to that, I think, is that, you know, we can't control how other people read our emails, although we can write them as carefully as possible. But we have some latitude in terms of how we interpret other people's emails. And so I think the question about thinking about why, you know, was the other person trying to upset me? Were they not trying to upset me? Why was their email so brief? Why was it so long? We tend to try to figure out what's going on with the other person. And I think they're trying to at least making some sort of assumption toward imagining that they have good intentions, or at worst, sort of neutral intentions, is going to be very helpful.
Some of the other questions that people have asked about the book, a couple are quite related, about whether what to do if the other person is genuinely just very difficult, or even perhaps mentally ill, or what to do if the other person really does have bad intentions. And it seems that if you go into a conversation with that in mind, in many ways you're almost letting yourself off the hook, or trying to, saying, no matter what I do, it's not going to work.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a complicated mindset, because on the one hand, there are people out in the world who maybe are having mental challenges in some way, or personality challenges. And so we don't want to pretend that they don't exist. And on the other hand, I think sometimes we're too quick to just say, well, I've done everything I could. The problem is that they have these, you know, emotional challenges. And once we've made that decision, we are letting ourselves off the hook. And, you know, if we really have tried everything, then that's all that we can do. So on the one hand, it's important to give ourselves a break and recognize, you know, we can't control everybody. We can't fix everything in the world just by having good conversations and using our good communication skills. On the other hand, you know, we don't want to give up too soon. We do want to really bend over backwards to try to make sure that they're hearing our message and that we're hearing their message.
In the last couple of minutes that we have, Doug, for listeners who are maybe anticipating or maybe dreading a difficult conversation, either in the workplace or school or in their family or with a neighbor or friend that they're going to have, what are some tips that you could offer right now?
So one thought is around how to decide whether to have the conversation itself, just whether to even raise something. Some conversations you have to have because they show up at your doorstep or your boss calls you in and starts having a conversation with you. Other conversations, though, are optional. You can raise that issue you're having with your sister or you can ignore it. And I think one of the things that we tend to do is we tend to follow this little cycle where we think, okay, I'm having a problem with my sister, so that I should talk to her about it. And then we think, how's it going to go if I talk to her? It's going to go badly. Therefore, I'm going to ignore it. And then we think, but I have this problem, so I have to talk. And we keep going around the circle. And we can't figure out, like, should I have it? Should I ignore it? If I ignore it, I'm going to still have the problem. If I have it, it's going to go badly. And there's no right answer as to whether to have a conversation or exactly when. But what I would say is when we're making the choice, I think we give sometimes too much weight to just the feeling of, well, this is going to go badly if I have it. So we think, you know, that's going to make me uncomfortable. It's going to make me anxious, et cetera. And so very often, because of the short-term unpleasantness of having it, we decide, okay, we're not going to have it. And then that feels like a good decision because it removes a certain amount of short-term pain. But what it doesn't take into account is that there may be the long-term pain, which we don't tend to focus on. Long-term pain may be worse than the short-term pain. And so my suggestion is not that you should have every time you have a problem with your sister, you should call her up immediately. That's not the advice from my point of view. It's simply think about whether you should have the conversation, think about the short-term pain, but also think about the potential long-term pain. And if you've thought about it clearly, then you can make a good choice about whether to actually engage in the conversation.
Well, this book is chock full of ideas for people to navigate the difficult conversations that we have all the time. And it is the chosen book for Conflict Resolution Month in Colorado. Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most. And I've been speaking with one of the co-authors of the book, Douglas Stone. Thank you very much for being with us this morning on KGNU, Doug.
It's my pleasure to be here.